Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war.
Welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage. Okay, I've been traveling all over the continent for the last several months, and starting next week, we're going to be bringing you live programs once again. But with this edition, I want to bring you some powerful statements from a lot of good people who attended the Exit Strategy from the War on Drugs conference, which was put together by the King County Bar Association in Seattle, Washington.
I'd like to give a special welcome to our many visitors who have come from other places, other countries, particularly our friends from Canada, and a special thanks to our featured speaker, Senator Nolin. I want to emphasize that this is a broad-based effort of professional, civic, and educational and healthcare organizations, and that is one of the features that gives it its strength. I'm Dick Monroe. I'm the chair of the Drug Policy Project. Just a short word about the program. I think a couple of things stand out. The title is quite descriptive, Exit Strategy. But our focus will be more, I think you'll find, not on the failures of the war, but how we get out of it. Where do we go from here? What are the alternatives? I think that's what people here want to hear, and that will be the focus. There will be some discussion about the elements of the war, of course, itself, because that discussion helps inform where we go from here. Nick Licata. Nick is a Seattle City Council member. He is the chair of the Public Safety and Civil Rights Committee. He is also the chair of the City of Seattle's Marijuana Policy Review Panel.
I'll make this brief. I just want to make three major points. One is that Seattle has made important, I think, progressive steps in the drug reform movement. Two, over the next couple of years, I think we'll have additional steps that we'll be taking. And three, I would like Seattle to be in the forefront, if not the leader, in drug reform in this nation, and we need your help to make that happen. Now, let me first say that regarding what we have done, through an initiative of citizens, we passed an initiative, and some eastern cities may not have that, but in the western cities you do. You get enough signatures, you get something on the ballot, and we were able to pass Initiative 75. It established a marijuana policy review panel, also collecting of data, and an analysis of what's going on. And basically, there was, in fact, an article, I think, in the PI not too long ago, pointing out that as far as just single marijuana drug arrests are concerned, reduced to 35 this year, and a few years ago was as much as 500. So we're assuming it had some impact, but the policy review panel will make a comment on those findings. So we have at least begun to go down the road of looking at, with regards to, let's say, recreational drugs, usually marijuana is identified as one, looking at making that the lowest priority for enforcement and looking at law enforcement more serious things. Secondly, this coming year, I was able to get into our budget a sizable amount of money for what I've labeled in the past a Civil Streets Initiative, which basically means looking at public safety with law enforcement and social services. In other words, beginning to look at the people who are chronic offenders, often are, in fact, people who are self-medicating, who are basically people who are unfortunately stuck on drugs, drug addicts. So looking at a harm reduction model, outreach to those people who are often what's referred to as sort of redundant petty criminals, sometimes homeless folks. How do we allow our law enforcement to work closer with social services? We have enough money now to establish a pilot program in one or two neighborhoods. We're going to begin to design it. I think we can make real progress in that area. And lastly, in the area of what we can do in the future, I think that it's critical that we think of the drug problem as an urban problem. I know that there's a lot of labs out in the rural areas, but when you look at the number of arrests, you look at the number of people who are receiving treatment, they're almost usually in large urban areas. There are over 100 cities in the United States with populations over 200,000. We need to begin to think about how taking elected representatives like myself across the country in large cities to have them work together, exchanging information. We need you to help that process, and we can use cities like Seattle or use Seattle as let's push the envelope. I've got four more years on the city council. I want to dedicate that time to establishing Seattle as a drug reform capital of the United States. I want to next introduce Gary Mihara, president of the King County Bar Association, on just one quick comment. The reputation that King County Bar Association has is worldwide with the work they've done on drug reform. I think we should be very proud of what's going on with the King County Bar Association. Let's give a warm welcome to Gary.
Thank you, Nick. Good morning, everyone, and to our guests from out of Seattle, and most especially our honored guests from Canada, the Netherlands, and the United Kingdom. Welcome to the friendly skies of Seattle, Washington. Thank you so much for joining us for this very historic occasion. I'm the president of the King County Bar Association. We are a volunteer organization of lawyers made up of 6,000 attorneys. And I have the privilege of continuing our strong partnership with our friends and leaders from the medical, legal, and community at large, including our civic leaders, in our war on drugs. This partnership developed as a result of an outpouring of interest from lawyers, judges, and community activists in response to an editorial written by our then president, Fred Noland. Written 5 years ago, President Noland lamented over his belief that the war on drugs in America was a failure. His editorial created the seed which blossomed into our drug policy project today. Of course, the other fortunate circumstance that occurred was finding a committed director of the drug policy project. That person set forth a path leading toward a new model. Roger Goodman was that leader. He came forth and was so committed to the idea of drug reform that he was willing to volunteer his time toward this effort. So this historic meeting today is the result of many years collaboration on Roger's part and his staff, Acela and Rachel. On a sad note, Roger, our condolences. I understand your father recently passed away, and you jetted back last night to be here on this important date, so thank you. I am particularly proud of the resolution that the King County Bar Association adopted earlier this year. In our resolution, we requested the state legislature to establish a special consultative body made up of public officials, civic leaders, and medical experts in the field to seriously review our current drug policies. Thereafter, the medical associations and even our own state bar association followed suit and adopted their own resolutions.
Next up, Director of Drug Policy for the King County Bar Association, Roger Goodman.
Appreciate you coming from all over the country and all over the world to join us in sunny Seattle. This really is the culmination of many years of work, the fact that we are sitting here today. We're not to waste our time, but you are a highly educated audience, and so this is really a conference by experts for experts. And we're also not going to waste our time to rail against the war on drugs. That's old news. And it's even old news that the Bar Association is speaking about it. That was the news item a few years ago. Now we're going to get down to some hard work. And we're going to get to some nuts and bolts questions that the public and public officials are clamoring for. What do we do instead? I saw an article, one of the briefings in the New York Times the other day, the prosecutors have announced that they have dealt a mortal blow to the infamous Ciudad Juarez drug cartel, that the so-called doctor, Ricardo Garcia Urquiza, was finally apprehended. And so the Ciudad Juarez cartel is finally shut down. And so we all know what this means. This means that a huge business opportunity has been created in the area of Ciudad Juarez for a more intelligent and well-organized cartel to take over. So number one has been taken out. Number two is just going to fill his place. And number 50 is going to become number 49, and so on. So this is an endless struggle, if you want to call it that. I believe it's an unethical policy because it's a war meant not to be won, but to be waged. I also don't necessarily like the phrase war on drugs, because when we declare war on something, we expect it to end, and we expect either to win or to lose. But this really isn't going to end, and it hasn't ended. So let's change our focus and talk about prohibition. We think prohibition, oh, that was the 1920s. Well, no, we have prohibition today, and we've had it for a long time. Or a prohibition policy, you can think of it that way. So our discussion today and tomorrow is going to be talking about what is beyond the prohibition-based policy. How can we look at regulatory measures that are more rational to achieve the objectives of the drug policy project in general, which are we need to keep these objectives in mind all the time, in no particular order, to reduce crime and disorder, to improve health, both public health and personal health, to protect children, and to save money, to use our scarce public resources more wisely. So this is about health, crime, kids, and money. So these are legitimate public objectives. There's no hidden agenda here. And I think we're very lucky, all these great minds in the same room together to work on more rational solutions. The first thing we're going to do, I'll just briefly go over the day. We're going to begin with a panel on how did we get here? How do we get into this mess? What is the history of drug use, not just the drug laws? And then what is the history of the attempt to control drug use? But not just the history, the culture. What's the cultural context in which we look at this problem, this challenge? And that, to me, is one of the most fascinating things, where we aggressively promote mind-altering and mood-altering and pleasure-inducing substances on television. Be some woman running through a field of flowers. I don't even know what the drug is, but I want it. and yet, for other substances, we are locking up hundreds of thousands of people and ruining their lives, sort of on an arbitrary basis. And there are cultural reasons behind that, and we need to explore that. So that'll be the first panel. The second one this morning will be to talk about, now we know how we got here, what's going on today. Let's describe this mess a little bit. Problems of civil rights and of racial disproportionality and of doctors not being able to practice medicine competently and so on. And we want to talk about that not again to rail against the war on drugs, but to identify the key problems so that we can inform how we can back out of this. We're in a thicket. We can't go through it. We have to back out of this. That's the way I look at the next steps for changing drug policy. Senator Nolet is here, the pioneer of Canadian drug policy reform. Thank you very much for coming. And he will give our luncheon address, offering some lessons from our northern neighbor. And following that, we will have a panel on what is going on in Canada and in Europe and around the world that isn't allowed to happen in the United States. Some innovations within this prohibition-based framework that is helping to reduce harm and helping people, but we can't even do it here. So we want to learn from around the world. The other day I got an email. I get a lot of spam. My email address is on the website for the King County Bar Association, so I'm a spam magnet. I got a lot of interesting stuff about refinancing and about enhancing pleasure and so on. Well, this is the one that I don't have a PowerPoint or anything to show you. I'm just going to read this. This is a photograph of a woman in a bikini-type thing, sitting in the lotus position with her eyes closed, trickling water in the background. She's just looking lovely. Introducing the tiny happy pill, the Serenity Mood Enhancer. Just imagine a mood enhancer that can change your life for the better and has absolutely no known side effects. Serenity customers see results in 1 to 3 weeks. That's all it takes. you will know within your first bottle if serenity is for you. We invite you to try a bottle of serenity. If you're not satisfied, we'll give you your money back. Click here and change your life now. So this is the kind of stuff that's being circulated. And this isn't illegal, I guess. You know, we're not locking up people for taking the serenity mood enhancer. Americans are expected to be drug-free in a society in which both legal and illegal drugs...
Did the web address?
Oh, the web address? Yeah. Let's see here, right. Yeah. It's actually called the happy pill. Yeah. Anyway. Sorry, I'm going to keep it for myself. Americans are expected to be drug-free in a society in which both legal and illegal drugs are used to remarkable excess. Hundreds of thousands of Americans are routinely arrested and incarcerated each year for possessing and using certain prohibited psychoactive substances. But at the same time, the American commercial marketplace is flooded with attractive media images and messages aggressively promoting these mind-altering and mood-enhancing substances to treat various new disorders or syndromes to satisfy the American appetite for instant gratification. I have just a few clippings that I needed to share with you before we get into the historical and cultural context, and I'll be sprinkling some remarks, I'm sure. This is from back in the 1930s. A man, this looks like a doctor, who's injecting marijuana into a woman's arm. I don't know how you do that. Daring drug expose, shame, horror, despair, marijuana, weed with roots in hell. What happens at marijuana parties? Lust, crime, sorrow, despair, shame, hate, smoke that gets in youth's eyes. Weird orgy, wild party, unleashed passions. Sounds like a pretty good drug, actually. This was the kind of thing that was circulated in the 1930s when marijuana was deemed to cause insanity. And that was why it was purportedly made illegal. Ironically or sadly, today we have the White House Office of National Drug Control attempting to show a clear link, a cause-effect, between marijuana use and mental illness. So here we have 70 years later, it's come full circle. Marijuana causes insanity again. Again, beware, young and old, people in all walks of life. This little marijuana may be handed to you by the friendly stranger. It contains the killer drug, marijuana, a powerful narcotic in which lurks murder, insanity, death. Dope peddlers are shrewd. They may put some of their drug in your tea or in your tobacco cigarette. So this was the kind of stuff that was going on, but today it's still going on, but in perhaps a more sophisticated and insidious form. Drugs have been around for a long time. The Delphi in Greece has just been discovered that there were psychoactive gases, methane and other gases, that were emanating from the Delphi that would give people visions, and that's why people would go there to have this sort of oracle, you know, about the future. So modern civilization was caused by mind-altering drugs, I guess we could say. We have a culture here where Viagra is again aggressively promoted and used for pleasure. And at the same time, cocaine, another drug used just for pleasure, is the reason to lock people up. We had in the year 2000, the presidential candidate refusing to talk about certain drug use in youthful indiscretion or whatever. But at the same time, the 1996 Republican presidential candidate was on television advertising Viagra, another drug, again, just used for pleasure. So we're going to begin to talk about that. Why is this, what is this arbitrary distinction that we make between one drug or another? Kids in particular are what we're concerned about. This was from the New York Times just last week. A jolt of caffeine by the can. I didn't have the time this morning to go and buy all of the cans of stimulant products that you can get very easily, you know, liquid energy, no fear, you know, Red Bull and that sort of thing. We live in a stimulant society, and we live in a society that really is fed by drugs and drug use, and so we can't deny that. We also live in a society where drugs are used to enhance performance, and we talk about performance-enhancing drugs on both the good side and the bad side. Steroids, for instance, are good for some purposes, but if you're in a professional sports league, well, that's an unfair advantage because it's a performance-enhancing drug. And if you take a look at the prohibited drugs, it's the same type of feeling, that these are performance-enhancing drugs. It allows us to expand consciousness and sensory experience, and yet it gives us an unfair advantage, and that kind of feeds into the moralism of why these prohibited drugs are looked down upon. We're about to enter the holiday period. The Mexican-American border is getting particularly busy right now because the amount of drugs consumed in the United States during the holiday period is higher than at any other time of the year, particularly alcohol. But the thing is that people aren't just getting high for the holidays. They're coping. They're coping with the stress of the holidays, and some of us know about that. but that's all okay. Meanwhile, people are here on the streets of Seattle coping with life, with other drugs, and that they're rounded up and and they're locked up, although not so much in Seattle anymore, and we're proud of that. You might remember Alan Greenspan's phrase, irrational exuberance, in the 1990s, when the stock market was going out of control and it just didn't seem right, but we were just riding along anyway, and the bubble finally burst. But there's a theory now that on Wall Street, all of the brokers and the financial folks were taking so many drugs to keep them up that the irrational exuberance of the market was actually fed by those drugs because per capita on Wall Street, these stimulants and mood-altering drugs were used to much higher degrees. So perhaps even our economy is driven, and I can say our economy is driven by drugs. We have all of these different syndromes, antisocial personality disorder, narcissistic personality disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, dissociative fugue, nicotine dependence, caffeine intoxication, malingering, religious and spiritual problems, phase of life problems, occupational problems, and each of these have a drug to solve. So all you have to do is take a pill in America, and you get better. So this is the point. We live in a society where drugs are an integral part of the modern world. We can't get rid of them and don't necessarily want to because many have therapeutic benefits. But any critical examination of our current drug policies, as well as any recommendations on how to back out of this, as I said, any meaningful reform, must reflect an understanding of this paradox of drug use in America. We are a nation that purportedly eschews drug use, and yet we consume drugs with abandon. So crafting more effective policies to address the chronic problem of substance abuse and to address the problem of our drug laws requires an exploration of the history, the historical and the cultural context of the use of psychoactive substances across human history, particularly in the United States, and also to review the attempts to control drug use, again, particularly in the United States, to inform us on where we want to go.
Again, that was Roger Goodman of the King County Bar Association. We'll be hearing more reports from Seattle in the coming weeks. And now we're going to return to somewhat regular Drug Truth Network programming, at least for the Cultural Baggage Show.
It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects.
Body odor, headaches, thinning hairline, increased sex drive, depression, mood disturbances, agitation, high blood pressure, severe anxiety and rage, kidney or liver disease, suicidal thoughts, rape, murder, and war. Beware, nearly 50% of the Earth's population produces large amounts of this drug and seeks to inject it into the remaining population. Time's up. The answer, testosterone. It's in the bag.
Poppygate, bizarre news about the U.S. policy on controlling heroin, featuring Glenn Greenway.
Last week on Studio B with Shepard Smith, former DEA agent Robert Strang charged that over 90% of heroin available on U.S. streets is of Afghan origin. This is strongly denied by the Office of National Drug Control Policy, which asserts that most heroin in the U.S. comes from Colombia. However, in 2004, U.S.-occupied Afghanistan produced nearly 60 times more heroin than Colombia, according to the UN. In fact, Afghanistan now produces 6.5 times more heroin than the rest of the world combined. Incredibly, under U.S. occupation, heroin production in Afghanistan has increased nearly 30-fold. This week in Moscow, a 13-year-old boy found to have nearly a kilogram of U.S.-Afghan heroin hidden in his stomach after arriving on a plane from Tajikistan. The boy, who was traveling with his mother, was arrested and taken to a children's hospital where the heroin was extracted from his body. This is Glenn Greenway reporting for the Drug Truth Network.
The U.S. Office of National Policy continues to play numbers games. Recently, the Drug Czar announced that poppy cultivation in Afghanistan had been reduced by almost half. As usual, there is both less and more here than meets the eye. It is a fact that both the U.S. and the United Nations report that less total land area was devoted to poppy cultivation in 2005 than in 2004. And they're probably right, but that's only poppy cultivation, not opium production. The 2004 Afghan opium poppy crop had very low yield because of drought and disease. As a result, farmers were forced to sow seeds far and wide, using much more land than usual. They succeeded in producing a near-record amount of opium that year as a result. This year, the rains were good, the plants healthy and high-yielding. The U.S. claims that opium production declined by maybe 10% this year over 2004. The UN, a little more realistic, only 2%. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org.
Okay, as we're closing out today's program, I think it important to note that the U.S. government is trying once again to revitalize Harry J. Anslinger's story that the use of marijuana leads to insanity. This from Health Day News. Heavy marijuana use may increase the risk of schizophrenia in adolescents predisposed to the brain disorder, this according to a new U.S. study. Researchers at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City used a brain imaging technique called diffusion tensor imaging to study the brains of 12 younger and 12 older healthy male adolescents. They found repeated marijuana use to be associated with abnormalities in the development of a specific language auditory pathway in the brain. Quote, because this language auditory pathway continues to develop during adolescence, it is most susceptible to the neurotoxins introduced into the body through marijuana use, end quote. So said researcher Manzar Ashtari, an associate professor of radiology and psychiatry. The study found no abnormal development changes in this language pathway in the brains of the healthy adolescents, and the researchers did detect abnormalities in the brains of both marijuana users and schizophrenia patients. The findings suggest that in addition to interfering with normal brain development, heavy marijuana use in adolescents may also lead to an earlier onset of schizophrenia in individuals who are genetically predisposed to this disorder, end quote. All of this proves that the reefer madness monster may never die. Well, I hope you forgive a few glitches and stumbles along the way for today's program, but I've been sick as a dog. And as always, I remind you that because of drug prohibition, you really don't know what's in that bag. And so I urge you to please be careful. To the Drug Truth Network listeners around the world, on behalf of engineer Philip Guffey, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage and the Unvarnished Truth. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.
Jap dancing on the edge of an abyss.